Well, welcome back to Fear or Favour. This week, I'm in Paris because I'm filming here. We're going to talk about the Crown Prosecution Service and in particular, the changes have occurred. Just to set the scene. So the Crown Prosecution Service, from my understanding, was something that was really created to try and create that impartiality between the police and the justice system. And I know when I first started policing, police themselves used to prosecute cases within the magistrates' court. But of course, it's now changed massively for the better. There's no doubt about that. Nazir, it's been your life.
Thanks for reminding me. No, absolutely. I mean, it was set up in 1985. There was a Royal Commission. It followed on from a series of very high profile miscarriages of justice. So some people will know about the Guildford Four, the Birmingham Six, and there are many others in which there was no check to the police investigation before it went into court. And so the Royal Commission recommended that there ought to be an independent body that acts as the gatekeeper, in effect, for cases before they get into the courtroom. And the Crown Prosecution Service was then set up in 1986. I joined it a couple of years later, but in essence, it's relatively straightforward. I mean, historically, it's gone through various iterations. When I first joined, it's headed up by somebody called the Director of Public Prosecutions. And when I first joined it, Sir Alan Green was the DPP for a little while, because he was caught with a sex worker in King's Cross.
Do you know, it's a funny story that, because I actually ended up having to speak to him about something.
Not about that, I hope.
No, it was about something else. And I phoned him up. And he was really pleasant, really chatty. And we did actually end up talking about that. But yeah, it's amazing how he fell from grace.
No, he was actually very, very good. I mean, any interactions I had with him, obviously he had better interactions with sex workers at King's Cross. But, you know, it was interesting. It was made me realize, actually, that people do fall on their swords when they're caught with their pants down, I guess. So he was replaced by somebody called Barbara Mills, who was the first ever woman DPP, and she was a bureaucrat in many respects, and it was necessary. We when we first started, we didn't have any key performance indicators, we didn't measure anything, which was great for me because I could just go to court and do my thing. But then we started measuring how conviction rates, etc. And then I was appointed assistant chief by somebody called Sir David Calvert Smith QC, who was a DPP at that time, and he was phenomenal. I mean, he was quite an extraordinary man. And still, you know, he was head of the parole service afterwards, somebody I really had a lot of time and respect for. And, you know, a real brave man, because I was appointed to the senior management 3 months after 9/11, which, you know, 9/11, Muslims around the world were you know, suspicious. People were suspicious of us. And suddenly he says, well, I'm so suspicious of you, I'm now going to make you the senior manager for London, which I thought was a phenomenal
The great achievement. But let me just take you back slightly. I think our listeners will be very interested to know the path that you took. But you became went through the solicitor, the lawyer process. But what made you join the Crown Prosecution Service rather than go into private practice?
You know, if I wanted to plug my book, The Prosecutor, I would. Available in all good bookshops. It basically started. I did a bit of defence work when I first started, very small amount, and I was in a police station with a rape suspect, and he was in those days there was no video disclosure, so now victims would give their evidence on video. Back then it was by written statement. So I'm sitting with the suspect who's about to be interviewed by police, and I have in front of me the written statement of the victim, and I'm reading it to him to get his view, and I realized he was getting off on it. And I thought, I can't do this. Okay. I said, I can't do this anymore. So I did my job, and then I walked out of the room and I decided I'm quitting. So I quit. I realized that what I wanted to do was build strong cases against that bastard. Rather than try and get him off. I mean, let's put it bluntly, though, defense solicitors, we need them. They've been starved of legal aid, etc. So we do need them. All of us need them at some point, but it wasn't for me. So I decided to move to London to join the prosecution service, which was probably quite a bold move because we weren't liked by anybody. We weren't liked by you lot, the police, because we'd taken over your responsibility for case preparation and charging. The public hated us because we weren't properly funded and we were losing files. Politicians hated us because they didn't really want us in the first place. Defense community hated us because we'd taken all their best lawyers. So it wasn't a very popular move for me anyway, but it was the best move. And it allowed me to flourish. I was able to do cases way beyond my pay grade. You know, literally 2 years in, I was prosecuting serial killer, you know, whereas, you know, if I'm sure if I was a defense lawyer, I would never have got that opportunity.
It's a great opportunity. I just want to take you back. You know, you talked about that rape case. Roger Grafe, who filmed a record, who sadly passed away fairly recently, he made this incredible program with the Thames Valley Police.
He did.
Around rape victims.
Yeah.
It was groundbreaking, wasn't it? Because it, for the first time, we looked and we watched and we saw how victims of sexual abuse were being treated by the police.
I can't believe, firstly, that the police allowed that to happen, you know, get the cameras in to watch them, warts and all. But that just shows you a lack of self-awareness, really. We saw the victims were being treated really shabbily. They were the ones on trial rather than the suspect. And Roger, you know, as you say, recently passed away, a real icon in TV production, but it showed what needed to change, and we quickly began to change that. So, you know, the prosecution service realized that it needs to be more than prosecution. It needs to be about the support it offers victims. It needs to be thinking about policy. So pretty early on, I got a bit of experience. If you want to move into senior management, you have to do some policy work. So for about a year and a half, I was doing some CPS policy work, developing the legislation that's now the Serious Sexual Offences Act. And, you know, I was working closely with government ministers or government civil servants. You know, I got phenomenal opportunity, but the CPS does that.
How difficult was that? I mean, the problem of moving into, this has always been the problem and the challenge, certainly a challenge that I always face, is like, do I move from being a practitioner to being a manager and lose that ability to be the front line?
I hated it, but I knew it was necessary.
Yeah.
So I did it for a really time-limited period of 18 months and then got lucky with David Cowell-Smith promoting me. But, you know, because some people stay and do that for 10, 20 years. I can't sit there. I'm not a detail man.
No. You're a practitioner, aren't you? You're a doer.
I like being an advocate. I like appearing in court. I like, you know, literally talking about stuff and as you say, doing rather than going and reading through paperwork and looking through academic books and stuff like that. I'm the shittest lawyer in the world. You know, I don't know anything about the law, but I know where to find it. And I think that's the important thing, is to recognize that.
So on this challenge. You've been made now the boss.
I'm now the boss. And that means that I can now think about doing well. You didn't have to, but I decided actually it was more important to look at what the public wanted. Strange as it may sound, it was quite a calculated decision by the government, Thatcher's government, to not call it the Public Prosecution Service, because most countries have a public prosecutor. They called it the Crown Prosecution Service, and that was, I think, a mistake, because the public didn't realise that the prosecutor was their prosecutor working on their behalf, and we were detached from them. So I decided, no, I'm gonna get out there and start talking to the public and understand what their priorities are, what their insights are, what the problems are, and quickly, before you knew it, once you opened the door, Mark, they were all coming in and telling me about this, that, and the other. And, you know, and I was picking on all these. I had the good fortune of being able to pick on all these phenomenal subjects that nobody had ever touched before. Airport crime, for example, because Heathrow was in my catchment area. And I realized there was so much crime happening in that airport. And so I organized this conference. Strangely, the only thing I remember about that conference, Mark, was that we were sitting in the conference with 400 practitioners from customs and police, and et cetera, and I'm on the platform opening the conference, and Richard Keel wheels in. You know Richard Keel, Jaws from the from Octopussy and Spy Who Loved Me. He was in the wrong place. He was in the hotel, but I'm on the stage and I say, Mr. Keel, you're in the wrong place. That's the only thing I remember about that conference, by the way. But you know, I then it was honor-based abuse and forced marriage, and I was literally doing this in order to begin to bridge the gap between what the public wanted and what the CPS did. And we were making massive progress. But so let me talk about what the CPS does in terms of case judgment. So we have, or they have, I'm not there anymore, they have something called the Code for Crown Prosecutors, published every year, placed before Parliament. CPS, by the way, is superintended by the Attorney General. She doesn't tell them what to do, but she has to answer questions on their behalf in Parliament. And so every year, the Code for Crown Prosecutors is revisited, changed if necessary, and put before Parliament. And what it does is it says there are two tests. So if you're any prosecutor, junior, senior, most serious case, doesn't matter, you have to two tests. The first, we all recognize, I imagine, is the evidential test. Is there enough evidence to provide what's called a realistic prospect of conviction? Is it more likely than not that this case would lead to a conviction? That's the first test. And that is a legal judgment, a factual judgment, judgment based on the evidence. If you don't have enough evidence, you go back to the police and say, get me A, B, and C. The second test.
Nazir, just stay with that. Stay with that. Yeah. Let's break that down. So that evidential test is a subjective test.
Yes.
So it's a subjective test by the individual that receives the evidence.
Yes.
How does one make sure that that subjective test is a fair and balanced and not an opinion?
Yeah. Well, this is where you have proper line management. So supervisors are meant to check your decision making on the more serious cases. You escalate cases as needs be. There is, as I mentioned earlier on, about policy. The prosecutor has to apply the policy. So the policy says you charge X rather than Y or Z rather than A, you know, whatever the charge might be. They have to follow that. They have to make sure that the law is appropriately applied. It's not a tick box, but there is a process to follow. And that applies to everything from a speeding conviction to multiple murder. But obviously with multiple murder, you take a little bit more time. So I think the evidential test, I think people understand. It's not very, very well articulated by the CPS. I am concerned that they're not talking publicly anymore. But when I left in 2015, we were really out there engaging, doing documentaries and talking to the news. And now they've gone inwards and they've stopped talking about things, which is, we can talk about that a bit
it
later.
It is worrying. So test one, evidence.
Test two, the public interest test. And this is probably one that people don't really understand. But it's not about whether the public are interested. It's whether in the public interest, is it right to prosecute this case? And I use this example to try and get people to think about it. So there was a doctor. She just graduated. She'd finished that day. She was about to begin her career as a doctor. And you know how difficult it is to do that. And secondly, you know how few doctors there are and how many more we need. She goes out with her friends. They have a lot to drink. They decide in the days when you could, I imagine, took the tires of a vehicle and left it on some bricks. Now you've got locking nuts, so it's a bit more difficult to do. But back then they did that. And what happens? The car falls off the bricks. And she's arrested. And she says, and her solicitors say quite rightly, if she gets a conviction for criminal damage, she will not be able to continue her medical career. And that's the end of it. But she's prepared to pay compensation. She's prepared to accept what's called a police caution. And you can rest assured we'll never, ever see her again in a courtroom or a police station. And so the question is that you balance that. Yeah, we could have convicted her, but on balance, nobody had lost. The compensation had been paid. She was able to continue her career. I don't know where she is now, right now, but I imagine after 25 years, she's probably a very senior consultant now. All of that would not have been possible if we'd prosecuted her. So the public interest test is applying a balance. And the age of the person, you look at any mental health issues that might arise. You look at basically a grand scheme of things, which are all listed in the code, which enable you to make that judgment. But it's really more subjective, strangely, than the other subjective test, because it really is down to this person, the offender, as well as the offence. But of course, let's say this, the more serious the offence, the more likely it is in the public interest to prosecute it. So nobody gets off on a murder on public interest grounds. Nobody gets off on a rape on a public interest grounds. You know, they are always prosecuted.
And how significant is it that perhaps a story makes the headlines? So we get some stories that make the headlines. And then as a result of that, there is a big campaign.
That makes a difference because, generally it makes the headlines. Let's say, I don't know, some officer is charged with indecent or suspected of indecent activity of some kind, exposure or something. Not that there's a real one happening right now. The view is that, look, this guy's got mental health issues, blah, 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 blah. And the decision might be taken. We might not prosecute him. he can be dealt with internally through police grievances. But the public hear about it. The public are aghast at what might be happening in this particular case. Of course, that preys on the mind of the prosecutor. And quite rightly so. We are the public's prosecution service. So it may well be that that decision is revisited. I should say that there's always a victim's right review now. So if a victim of a crime isn't happy with the decision not to prosecute, they can get it reviewed by a more senior prosecutor and a different prosecutor. So, but, the point is that we can't close our eyes and ears to what the public think. And if they start doing that, Mark, we're in a really bad place because we're robots. We're acting without any without any responsibilities to the communities that we serve. And so I think, the process itself, it sounds a little bit complex and it sounds a little bit bureaucratic, but actually it works and has worked for 35 years now in the vast majority of cases. There are undoubtedly going to be occasions. Yeah, I dealt with the Rochdale grooming gang case, which you know. And in that case, originally, the decision was taken not to prosecute those guys. So there are many cases, I have no doubt, where the wrong decision was taken originally. But again, the opportunity presented itself for me anyway to revisit that. But I think people need what's happened over the last 5 years should be worrying to our listeners, because the CPS has gone inward. It's gone into the shadows again. As it where it was 25 years ago. Because of all the publicity around rape convictions being so poor and such, they've decided not to engage anymore. I did a documentary panel discussion with Channel 4 a few weeks ago where there were 60 rape victims in the room and I was the only man in the room. And the only reason they asked me was that CPS has said, no, they're not going to offer somebody up for that program. So they were scared to sit in a room with victims camera. And it doesn't matter that the DPP or whoever says, oh, we are engaging. The proof of the pudding is that they're not doing it publicly.
They're not. I want to talk about public interest and interest to the public. There was a case that I had a dealing with, which was Henry Vincent, and that was in April 2019, when he was stabbed. He broke into a house, Richard Osborne Brooks, and as a result of breaking into the house, he was stabbed. Now, the inquest ruled unlawful killing. He was arrested on suspicion of murder, but then released without charge. Now, that created a real public outcry in terms of safety in your own house. If someone breaks into your own house, how far can you go to defend yourself? Now, he wasn't prosecuted. There was a verdict of unlawful killing. And I just find that, I think that probably really drums home this aspect of, in the public interest, etc. That created huge public headlines. People were going, it cannot be right for a man to break into a house. Yes, he died. And of course, that's tragic. But the consequences of his actions were the result of
Mark, I did three of those in the same summer of 2011. Three burglars broke into properties in Manchester a month after another. They weren't listening to me. I decided not to prosecute the first one. They broke in again. They were killed. I decided not to prosecute the second householder and the third householder. But straight again, this is a bit of confusion here. That wouldn't have been a public interest decision. That's an evidential decision. On the evidence, the householder was acting in self-defense.
Yeah.
That's a legal defense. So it shouldn't have got as far as the public interest test. On evidence, you do not prosecute the householder for protecting their property or their person or another person. So,
I suppose what it does is it flips the side, is it's in the public's interest.
Yes, it is. I totally understand that. But as I say, that would, again, it's not a public interest test decision. That's an evidential decision. And again, when I had the three I prosecuted, the three cases that I decided not to prosecute the householders for, I made sure I did that on camera. I remember standing outside my office in Manchester where Sky News and all the other channels were there to say, I have decided not to prosecute this householder because you are entitled to protect. And there was a reason for doing that way. Not ego. I wanted people to know that you are safe in your own homes. That's a role for the estate. That if somebody does break in, they are the criminal, not you. And that as long as you use force that's necessary and proportionate, you remember the example of that farmhouse guy?
Tony Martin, the Norfolk farmer. Yeah,
that's the one. who'd built his house in such a way that burglars would get in, and then there would then he'd be able to kill them, shoot them to death. You know, that's a different. That would definitely not necessary and definitely not proportionate. Yeah, that's a very different kettle of fish compared to you and I confronting somebody just coming in through our back door or something. Not that I recommend, by the way, that you take up a knife and kill somebody.
So let's look at rape cases. This is something that always attracts an awful lot of attention. So the statistics give us that at the end of March 2020, 58,856 cases of rape were reported to police forces in England and Wales, but that led to just 2,102 prosecutions. Mm. Down actually almost 1,000 from the previous 12 months. Well, that's not going the right way. Why?
No, of course it's not. And that's why the CPS are hiding from scrutiny and hiding behind a new action plan or whatever else they've put in place. 1.7% of police reports end up being prosecuted, and about two-thirds of those, so about 1% of the whole number, end up being convicted. And that's led to people saying, I imagine quite rightly, that rape has been decriminalised in this country. And that,
I
really
mean, Dame Vera Baird, didn't she? The Victims Commission at the time said that her view was that it was leading to decriminalisation of rape.
Absolutely.
And let's give that context. So basically, crimes exist because they're on statute, because we say that there's a crime.
Yes.
If we take away the statute and the legislation, then people can do something. It's illegal to smash a window and break a window. But if we said it wasn't, we would be decriminalizing
it all the time. Exactly. Yeah. That's the worry about it. I mean, wasn't there a film called The Purge or something? Not that I've ever watched it.
Yeah, for a day in America, you can go and do what you want.
There's one day a year where the laws don't apply. You know, I'd be coming for you on that day, by the way, Mark. But, you know, the reality is that's what decriminalization means. It means that people feel that there is no justice. The victims feels that, quite rightly so. But also the perpetrators feel they can do what they like. And that is troubling. And that's why the CPS, given where the situation is, they should be upfront on TV, on radio, here on this podcast, talking to us, talking to you and saying, right, we are doing something about it.
But why have we got there? Why have we got in March 2020, after all Savile and all these changes that have been by far the better, just 1.4% of rape cases resulting in a charge
Why? Because we lost experience. So people like you left the police service and people like me left the prosecution service. So just by having new numbers, you've got new people coming out of police academy, new people coming into as prosecutors, all without the 20, 30 years experience that you and I had. So we lost a million years of experience. We've lost the resources that we used to have. We used to have specialist rape units, RAZOs, they called them, where joint police and prosecutors, they happened inconsistently around the country. That didn't happen for a while at all. Basically, you take away the people who knew what they were doing and replace them with people who we don't. Well, guess what's going to happen?
And I suppose the problem is we talk about rape cases because it's the most emotive, but this reflects in all kinds of cases. You know, I went to a stage when I joined the police service, we used to attend every burglary, and we'd attend every burglary. We'd do house to house. We'd get scenes of crime to every burglary. And our detection rates were quite good because we actually made the effort. You know, if somebody broke in through a window, we'd look to lift a print, or we'd take a, you know, blood if they'd left blood there. House to house was always good because you'd often get someone to say, well, actually, I saw a van there, and they give you the index and you investigate. The problem is now is that by and large, so many crimes are simply reported either online or through the phone. Mm-hmm. Police officers don't attend scenes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I, the amount of times I talk to people who reported crime, and not only do they have to hold on 101 for so long, if they do finally get through, they wait days for a police officer to attend.
You know, it's worse than that, because police will say to you, you say, oh, there's a bloody tissue here. They'll say, can you put it in a sandwich bag, please, and hold on to it until such time as we... You know, they're asking you, the citizen, to do their forensic examination for them, and then to seize the evidence, which, of course, you know, if it gets contaminated, it could never be used in a trial. You know, the SOCOs, as they call them, serial crimes officers, were always there at these offences. Now there aren't enough of them around. The forensic science laboratories we've discussed before, because they've been privatised, they don't necessarily send everything off to be looked at. We've talked about the CBS, but the police, both of them are in a really bad place. You know, they're working in with their hands tied behind their backs, and you, the public, are having to pay the consequences of that.
Well, in order for cases to be prosecuted and justice to be done, you have to have both the police and the CPS effectively working together.
Yeah.
And you know, one is integral to the other. One collects the force, the evidence, and the Crown Prosecution Service is the gatekeeper, enabling that evidence to be collected to such a value that it can be brought to justice. And the most frustrating thing about all of this, and the public are the eyes and ears of the police, but they aren't the police. No. And we have to say, you know, how has it become acceptable for the police force to now be in such a way that they can't attend crime scenes, they're getting the public to do certain pieces of evidence. And it always comes back to this point, and we've said it with all the recent issues about the Metropolitan Police, is that it's the role of the police to investigate. It's not the role of the public to investigate. No. And it has to be a point whereby, you know, when they say, well, is there any suspects linked to this case? I will close it. Well, no, there aren't, but you have to investigate to find it. If you turn up at a house burglary, the point to which you turn up at the house burglary as an investigator, there may be no suspects linked to this. But once you do some forensics, once you speak to the neighbours, once you look at the CCTV, you may end up with an index of a vehicle. You may end up with a photograph of an individual.
Absolutely.
You may end up with actually DNA linking an individual.
The police know what to look for. You and I, well, we will, but members of the public wouldn't know what to look for. And, you know, for example, when it comes to burglaries where people steal your motor vehicle by coming into your house, take your keys, the police should know, but that means a convoy of vehicles will be leaving the premises shortly afterwards. So they will know what's looking at CCTV, how to find that. They can't expect you to do that for them.
Mm.
But at the moment, we've got this silly stage now where, as you say, police leaders invariably are saying there isn't enough evidence before they've even looked for the evidence. And that requires, therefore, us to step into that role. And somebody asked me this question yesterday, you know, do I believe in a vigilante state? Of course I don't believe in a vigilante state. But people are beginning more and more to think that they need to take the law into their own hands and do their own investigations because they see the state not doing its job.
Something that worries me about the Crown Prosecution Service, and I was, you know, I was working with the Crown Prosecution Service in its early days, really. Do you remember the times when you would interview somebody in custody, you'd come out of the interview, and the custody sergeant would say to you, okay, so what have you got?
Yeah.
You'd then explain what you've got. And between you, you'd decide whether or not the individual is going to be charged.
Yes.
And you charge them. Now, of course, that's changed massively. Yeah. It's now a decision of the Crown Prosecution Service. And so in my latter part of the years, although it was slightly different, I did work very closely with designated Crown prosecutors because of the types of cases we were working with. We had allocated CPS representatives that we would put things to. And we got very quick responses to that. But so I haven't experienced this personally, but I've talked to lots of officers and colleagues who, of course, I work with all the time. And worryingly, they say to me, getting a response now from the Crown Prosecution Service on basic cases, not complex cases, because I think they're very delicated teams to do that. But it's the general large scale cases.
Well, they have something called CPS Direct now, which is for it's not for you, by the way, members of the public. It's for the police. So CPSD is a online phone service where an investigating officer or the custody sergeant, whoever it is, can ring up and say, well, here's the evidence. They email it over to the prosecutor, wherever that prosecutor may be, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the prosecutor is meant to turn it around relatively quickly and decide whether a charge is appropriate, what the charge should be, and or what further inquiries are needed. And I think the point has been made, although I think it might be improving. I've been speaking to people recently. Historically, though, there has been massive delay. There haven't been enough prosecutors on call. The system hasn't been very, very robust. And police officers have been sitting there waiting for hours by the end of on the edge of a phone or waiting for an email when they could be doing other things. And I think that in itself is a problem, given what we've said already about resources not being so tight.
And of course, other things that slow down the whole process of criminal investigations and the Crown Prosecution Service decision on charging is forensics. I mean, we have talked about this. We've done a podcast about it. But it still comes back to the point that forensics will delay you so much. And bearing in mind, most criminal cases now involve some element of forensics, whether it's digital.
They don't have a mobile phone, won't they?
Yeah, mobile phone. You know, and what we can tell from mobile phones is an incredible amount. You go back to certainly my early policing days. I mean, we didn't even have phones. It was funny. I saw a message that someone put on LinkedIn the other day, and they put a pager on there. And I thought, gosh, you know, that takes me back to the day.
I don't know about you,
but yeah, I mean, I used to carry a pager for certainly all my CID life before mobile phones. Yeah. I remember the first time we got a mobile phone in the office, just, and it was got for us basically for security. It was made, I can't even remember, it wasn't the police force that bought it, it was somebody else that had provided it. And it was just so that when we went out and did cases that we had some security there with mobile phones go. But yeah, I mean, we were controlled by pagers, so you didn't have that process whereby everyone now has a phone where we know where you are. And that slows a whole process down as far as criminal investigations.
Has now become the minefield that it is. There's a shortage of talent and expertise in this area. We need many more people. But you know, you're right. Everybody has a phone. Every case involves phones being investigated, and we just don't have the resources to do so.
Are you worried, Nazir, that the Crown Prosecution Service is at crisis?
Absolutely. I am more worried than I have been throughout my 25 years in the service. I've spoken to a few people this week about what needs to be done, and well, at the very least, we need to shine a light on this, Mark. I think.
And what would you put that down to? I mean, obviously, lack of communication is a massive thing.
Poor leadership. Yeah. Morale is really poor. By poor leadership, I mean this: if whatever your problems, you need to be out there talking about it. You need to be talking to the public and saying, "We understand you've got concerns." You don't hide away. Issue a press release or do your own little video for your own website, which is what they're doing apparently these days. Yeah. You, Max Hill, who's the current DPP, all the chief prosecutors should be on the television, on the radio, on a daily basis, trying to recover confidence. And that means accepting when they've got things wrong. That means accepting when they've got challenges, because public will have sympathy for you, for them, if they explain the challenges they face. But the lack of information, the lack of engagement has meant that we are filling that vacuum with all sorts of conspiracy theories, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, they're in a really bad place right now.
And do you think that as a result of that, it needs a clear out? It just needs a completely different approach. I mean, there's the scale of the demand upon the Crown Prosecution Service, and it's reflective in the scale of the demand against the police, has significantly increased.
Yeah.
Investigations are more complex now than they ever were.
It needs more resources, 100%. Crime is going up, but even when crime didn't go up, as you said a moment ago, crime has become much more complex. You can't just prosecute a burglary without looking at the forensics, without looking at the phone, without looking at the CCTV. Back in the day, they wouldn't have half of those things to do. So it's become much more complex and much more onerous. They're not resourced to do so. Morale is really low. The prosecutors I speak to within the service are depressed as hell. And I feel for them. I really do.
And do you think as a result of that, it means the Crown Prosecution Service won't attract the right people?
It would always attract people because it pays quite well. Mm. But where they come from? They come from the defence community. So the defence community gets diluted and ends up losing talent. So I think, you know, morale isn't, you know, they've just recruited about 80 prosecutors in the last few months, apparently, because the government gave them a bit of money. But they're brand new prosecutors. It'll take 5-10 years before they're ready to do the most serious cases. So I think we need to recognize they're on a journey. But I really want the DPP, the chief prosecutors, to get out there right now and start explaining to everybody what needs to be done and what they are doing, not just issue a press release.
How important do you think it is as a Crown Prosecutor to have done defence work prior to?
I don't think it's necessary, but I mean, I did a bit of it, and a lot of the prosecutors have done some of it. Many of them haven't, and I think that does affect them. Some of them will undoubtedly have not seen the other side of the coin, and it's even if they don't, even if they haven't done defence work, it would be good of them to sit down with defence lawyers to understand the challenges they face too. So I think it's always good to have that experience, but it's not necessary.
Something that I'm often asked, and I'm going to throw you a low baller here as a lawyer, but I think something that's always interesting is how, as a lawyer, when you're working defence work, can you defend some of these people who are, one would say, perhaps shouldn't be defended, that are utterly disgraceful, clearly lying, clearly unacceptable people, and the best place for them is in prison? Do you sometimes... would you understand how the public have that view?
But this is where the word defend is the wrong word. Represent is the word. Everybody's entitled to representation. You know, if you, I know the defense lawyers that deal with some of these cases involving the people that you and I might consider to be evil. You know, you've heard that phrase. Mm. But actually, they just represent them. If that person said to them, I didn't do it, well, I know if they said to that person, I did do it, and then tried to claim they were not guilty, then that lawyer can't act for that person. There's a rule about that. Yeah. But generally, their job is to make sure they get a fair trial. That's all. And it's not about being buddy with these people. You know, it's not about some kind of more nefarious issue. They just don't think it's right, and I don't think it's right, that nobody has representation in a courtroom.
How impartial, one of my massive concerns, and we've talked about this, senior management within the Metropolitan Police in particular, but it will apply to other police forces, is how difficult it is to make sure that you are impartial from the government, that you are not the eyes and ears. How separated do you think the Crown Prosecution Service is from government?
This is problematic. For a number of reasons. The first is the DPP, who's the head of the CPS, is technically a permanent secretary. So every week, every Wednesday, I think it is these days, he meets with all the other permanent secretaries of all the government departments. So they're civil servants, basically. But it must be difficult, shouldn't be, when a minister says, I want you to prioritise, X crime, Y crime, it would be difficult for the CPS to say, no, we're prioritising Z and A. So I think there has to be a bit of give and take. Generally, the ministers are reflective of the public's opinion. So there shouldn't be a problem about prioritising those areas. But sometimes ministers decide, for example, and you've got a government that wants to outlaw protest of some kind, you know, and says to the CPS, I want you to prosecute every protester. In those circumstances, the CPS should turn around and say, no, we will do our job. We'll follow the code. We'll apply the code for Crown prosecutors and decide whether or not cases should be brought. But again, it goes back to my point about transparency, Mark. Our prosecutors should be out there explaining to, not me, I'm not there anymore. They should be out here explaining to you and I what they're doing, why they're doing it, and how they're resisting whatever pressure is being thrown at them.
So we have multiple police forces, 42 police forces mm-hmm. in the country. Just explain how the Crown Prosecution works. It's a national body.
Yeah.
How does it break it? How's it broken down into areas?
That varies
areas?
On a daily basis. It's run by the Director of Public Prosecution. He has some central casework decisions, terrorism, for example, serious organised crime, fraud, tax. That tax is now dealt with by the CPS. So there's a specialist divisions that work directly in headquarters. Then every area has, they're not every area, by that I mean there are 13 regions. So Wales is a region, Southeast is made up of Surrey, Sussex and Kent. And they're all headed up by a chief prosecutor, as I was. And they have their own staff and lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. But they are meant to apply the same policies that emanate from the national force, and they, of course, they apply the same law. And they are independent of this DPP in the sense that they have to make the decisions based on what they know. But there are occasions when you escalate those cases to the DPP because they are high profile or they are so complex that requires ultimately his decision making.
Brilliant. Well, there's one other subject which I don't think we can have a crime podcast and not talk about, and that is the slapping of Chris Rock by Will Smith at the Oscars. incredible. Have you seen it?
Have I seen it? Of course I have. I mean, I did a speech yesterday in a conference, and I looked around the room and scanned. I said, just making sure that Will Smith's not here, you know? I think it's entered the public discourse. It was terrible. I mean, I'll be blunt about it. Will Smith was totally in the wrong. I don't care what Chris Rock said. Words are words. Being violent towards him in front of a billion audience in a live awards. And then even more amazingly, Mark, 10 minutes later, getting a standing ovation when he got his Oscar. And we've learned also that he refused to leave when he was told to leave. Mm. There's no excuse for raising your hand to somebody in these circumstances. It sends out the worst possible message to our children.
It does. And as you say, on one level, he gets up there, commits a criminal offence, and it was a criminal offence. It was an assault. He then gets praise moments later. You just think to yourself, hang on a minute, it's the duplicity of these individuals to be able to be in that position. What he did was utterly wrong. And, I know Chris Rock has said he's not going to prosecute, and as a result of that, the police aren't taking the matter any further forward. What he did was wrong, and he should be castigated for it. It's
100%. I mean, he should be persona non grata. And it sends, as I said, a really bad message to young people that, you respond to words with violence. Mm. And yes, nobody was hurt, I guess. But I do feel that it was so unnecessary. And most of us, I think, thought it might have been a setup of some kind.
I did think that. When I first saw it, I thought, has this been staged? Because it was so, it was just so out there, wasn't it? He gets up from his seat and not just hits him, then goes back and swears at
exactly.
him. Exactly. In his seat.
I know. I think it was the swearing that made you realize this wasn't some kind of setup. Get my wife's name out of your effing mouth, over and over again. I'm sure that meme is going to be used on a regular basis. I'm surprised Boris Johnson hasn't said that about his wife whenever she's mentioned. The reality is, it was a really bad day for the Oscars and for celebrities more generally. I hope that people do not simply rehabilitate Will Smith, even though I love him to bits. I grew up on The Fresh Prince.
Listen, brilliant actor, but we all have to be accountable for our actions. And I do hope the Oscars take a position against him and ban him from the Oscars.
Yeah, I think it's wrong to take away his statue, because if you start doing that, then you have to ask your questions about Harvey Weinstein.
Well, he won it, didn't he?
Roman Polanski, Mel Gibson. There was a whole catalogue of Oscar winners who've been rather naughty in later life,
But you see, I'm with you. I don't agree with taking away things that people won for things they did, but I am for behavior. As a result of his behavior, he should now be banned from Oscars events because his behavior has brought it into disrepute.
It's
as simple as that. He stands with his award. He can keep his award, but he shouldn't be allowed to go to any future Oscars.
100%. He can now go and live with his uncle and auntie in Bel Air.
Nazir, you're a star. Thank you so much. Well, thank you. That's another episode of Fear or Favour finished. Please do drop us emails. Loads of you are contacting us, asking us to look at certain cases, or just simply telling us how much you like our podcast. We love to hear from you. Every single one is read and responded to. So until next week, thank you very much. Look after yourselves and take care. Look after yourself, Nazir.
You too. Bye now.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.